Well, it's meeting order. We don't have a quorum yet. People seem to be a little slower than usual. And so we're going to start anyway. So we'll have the LaSalle Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Welcome to our community. Mark, good to see you again. Give your name for the record and tell us all about what you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, I guess it is. Thanks for having us. For the record, my name is Mark Johnson. I'm the Executive Director for the LaSalle Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. And with me is the LaSalle Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council's Assistant Director, Joe Pavelko. And somewhere, yes, in the gray, in the middle here, is Sandy Smith. She's the Program Analyst Manager for the council. So she's the brains behind the bunch.
Okay.
We'll give you a quick overview here of the historic view of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the council. Get it up on the screen.
Well, as Representative Gilius is here, we have a quorum, so we'll call this meeting officially to order. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess our PowerPoint is up on the screen. You also have color copies in front of you, Mr. Chair and members. So starting out quickly, if we go with, give you a quick historic overview, the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Act is where the funds for Outdoor Heritage Council come from. That was, as you know, ratified back in November of 2008, and it provided for 3/4% of new sales tax. That the revenue from those sales taxes goes into split into four dedicated accounts. One of those is the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and that receives about 1/3 of those dedicated sales tax dollars. It comes to about $100 million annually for the Outdoor Heritage Fund alone, and it is required statutorily as well as constitutionally for the Outdoor Heritage Fund to be used to protect, restore, and enhance wetlands, prairies, forests, and habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. I should mention one other thing. Actually, I'll get to it in a little bit. The council itself is organized under 97A.056 as part of the legislative branch, and the council makes recommendations to the legislature for appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So the legislature actually makes those appropriations. The appropriations, as you'll see later in another couple weeks when the bill comes before you, is that the appropriations go to, or the appropriation language will say in each one of them, to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for an agreement with XYZ, or to Bowser for an agreement with, or something of that nature. So the DNR has fiscal oversight, or Bowser has fiscal oversight, depending on which the appropriation language designates. But the council itself and the staff of the council oversee all of the accomplishment plans, the budget shifts, the proposed amendments to the accomplishment plans, etc. The council currently, actually this is as of December 31st, was this structure you see in front of us. There are four appointments from the House, four from the Senate, and four from the governor, four legislators total. Two from the House and two from the Senate, and one from each party being represented upon it. As you'll see here, starting with the top one, Representative Denny McNamara. Of course, he's not in office now. But it says appointee yet to be announced, and I put that purposefully behind the eight that are in limbo at this time, just because we haven't had announcements as to whether people have been reappointed or whether we have new appointees. But those hopefully will be happening soon.
You must be awful tough on these people.
Pardon?
You must be awfully tough on these people.
Mr. Chair, we try to do our best to make it easy for them, but it's a real labor of love, I must say. Each one of these members are really involved. From a standpoint of the vision or priorities of the council really tries to go with three basic tenets. One is accountability and conservation focus and science-based. The guiding principles of the council were developed in collaboration with, of course, the council, legislators, and stakeholders back quite a number of years ago at the beginning of everything. It comes down to a big-picture approach where for programs that are well thought out and that are well designed, and also programs that are of long-term impact and benefit and high value to fish and wildlife. The council looks, as the proposals come forward, they look at the proposals from five different ecological sections and have those defined as such. So we have the northern forest, which is in the pink there on the map, the forest prairie transition, which is in the yellow, the metro urbanizing area, of course, in the darker blue, southeast forest in Minnesota is down in that peach color or salmon color in the lower right, and then the rest of the state in the prairie, is, which is more the, I guess you call it an aqua color. Those, each one of those sections have their own unique outcomes. Some of the outcomes are will overlap or go from more than one area, but individual sets for the outcomes, and those are all listed in our call for funding request as it's put out each year. Some of the outcomes that are multiple are pretty obvious, such as keeping water upon the land, where you may see that for most of the projects, most of the sections, or all of them, maintaining healthy native plant communities, maintaining healthy animal communities, et cetera. From a timeline standpoint, to let you know how things happen, the call for funding requests is put out in April of each year, beginning of April, and then people have through the end of May to get their proposals in. And then the council goes through those proposals from a written standpoint and looks at criteria, basically ranking them and seeing what are the good points, what are the bad. Then also, by the time it winds up, we have pretty much October or November before the final recommendations of the council are laid out. In December, generally, that those are adopted and put into the final bill. And then it's the following July after appropriation when the funds are finally available to the recipients. So it's about a 15-month process overall as this goes about. The hearing criteria is, there's a listing of it here, and this, again, also is in our call for funding requests. But there's a constant goal of the criteria and of the council as they go through all these programs or potentials is to make sure that the best programs are recommended for appropriation. And, of course, the hearing criteria aren't the only thing. There are the hearings themselves, which the council gets a chance to ask more questions and see what else comes out of the woodwork. But at least the criteria give them a chance to prioritize what they think, at least from the paper standpoint and from what's in front of them, comes out on top. What's the cream of the crop? The programs funded in the prairie section, just a quick short list of these, were the Rim Wetlands for Bowser is one of the programs that now is in a multiple phase. I think it's probably phase 9 this year, I think, but for within the prairie section. Also the Minnesota Buffers Wildlife for Wildlife and Waters, which is Bowser, the Tallgrass Prairie Program, the Accelerated WPA or Waterfall Production Area Program, and Cannon River Headwaters, and that's just a very short example here. That photo is of the Lansfield Prairie, which was the first fee title acquisition in Clay County with Outdoor Heritage Funds, and previously was a pasture of the Lansford family who wished it to go into become an SNA, basically, and remain unplowed and virgin prairie for decades to come or for generations to come. In the northern forest section, some of the, again, a short list of projects are the Forest for the Future easement program, which keeps lands in working forests and in public and in private hands. The Critical Shoreland Habitat Program in northeastern Minnesota, the Lower St. Louis River Restoration, northeast Minnesota Moose Restoration, which is all on public land, and the Mississippi Headwaters Habitat Partnership, again. That's just a short list. The picture there is actually a view from a conservation easement that was purchased on Burntside Lake up by Ely. Sorry if I'm going through these fast, but I don't want to use up all your time. And you can always read and look back.
We'll make up the questions.
Sir. Pardon, sir?
We'll make up the time with all the questions we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll look forward to that. The programs funded in the Prairie Forest Transition section, this gives a short example of those, but the Accelerated Prairie Grassland Management on Public Lands program is one that's really gets a lot of acres and gets a lot of work done on public lands, again, bringing them up to par, catching up on old work and enhancement work primarily. The Prairie Heritage Program with Pheasants Forever, the Prairie Recovery Project with TNC, and also Shell Lakes and Wetlands Restoration Programs, both DNR as well as Ducks Unlimited. The picture again there is of the Gilfil and WMA, which is near Madison Lake in northeast Blue Earth County. And it was part of a, I believe it was a 2010 Outdoor Heritage Appropriation Program with the DU and DNR. In the metro urbanizing area, again, a short list. The and it runs it everywhere from, there's from acquisition of easements or fee title, not much fee title in the metro area because land is so expensive, but on into restoration and enhancement work. The be it easements in Dakota or Washington County or other counties, and leveraging bond referendum potentially to the Rum River Creek, Cedar Creek Conservation Area acquisition, to the Anoka Sand Plains Three Rivers Park District. Lake Rebecca is just one of their many projects there, or the Metro Big Rivers Habitat programs on the Minnesota, Mississippi, and St. Croix Rivers. There are, you know, others that you probably know of are Worth Park up in Golden Valley, or the U of M Landscape Arboretum on Chanhassen that have been able to also utilize funding from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. In southeastern Minnesota, again, a very short list, but the Lower Mississippi Habitat Restoration Program, Coldwater Rivers and Streams Restoration Enhancements, also the Accelerated Enhancement of Forest, Wildlife Habitat, and Aquatic Habitat Management. And there's the picture on the right. There are two pictures. I wish we have more like this. I just didn't have time to insert them, unfortunately. But this is a picture of down at Hay Creek, which is in Goodheave County, just south, and I believe a little east of Red Wing. It's the same corner, the same bend in that Hay Creek, which is a trout creek and a premier trout creek. But it gives an idea of before and after work, before being above, of course, where it was slow, wide, and choked. A lot of sediment in the bed of the creek and very slow-moving waters to where it was restored, and the channel was deepened, or at least I should say narrowed, to allow for swifter water movement and removal of the sediment through. So you ended up with a deeper or restored product with no degraded banks and buffered edges, and again, much better for habitat, much better for fish, much better for the trout. And a nice side effect was less flooding damage that would happen from then on the fields and to the river unit itself.
Representative Green, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, this picture is a few years old. I remember seeing it before. And the reason I brought it up is because I think, I don't remember if I asked last time or not, but obviously this is taken in two different seasons. And so I'm wondering, did you take samples of the water? Because it looks pretty blue in the top one there and pretty green in the bottom. Now maybe that's because there's no green above the one on the first, because it was probably taken in the fall. But it doesn't really look a fair comparison there. Are your other pictures kind of the same?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, actually, you're correct. These are two different seasons. It is fall and it is summer, actually. The upper one, the reason for the blue is that you have nothing but sky that's reflected in the water. And the lower one, you're actually seeing the forest behind the green forest that's providing the green. You don't have there's a little bit of blue in there, so you can kind of see where it peeks through. But otherwise, it's just the perspective of the photo. We do like to see our members come up, or project managers come with before and after photos, and it's close to the same season as possible, but we take what we get, and it's we do have others, though. And you're correct. This is a few years old. It was a 2010 acquisition. This bend, I believe, was finished 2 years ago, because that's when I saw it, and this was a picture from that point.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I was being a little smart there on the reflection. But I would be curious to know if you had taken tested the water for sediments and other nutrients that are in there before and after as well. And wouldn't it have been better to see the pictures in the same season?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I agree. I'd like that. I'd like to have pictures in the same season. I don't know if water, I don't believe water tests were taken, because they're typically not part of an Outdoor Heritage Grant. It's the restoration the habitat restoration work or the habitat enhancement work that's paid for by the grant. It could be that water was subsequently tested by DNR, but I don't have that information, and nor was that volunteered to us. I can tell you one thing, and that was that from a shocking standpoint, looking at the trot numbers before and after, my understanding that it was it's almost unbelievable number of fish per mile after the habitat work compared to before the habitat work. Incredible, incredible increase. To give you a couple of, these are going to be boring slides, but I hope you'll find them interesting. Council recommendations to date, or at least through the last legislative session, was $755 million from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. That's broken down into 228 different projects or programs. And you can see how that breaks down per year. Keep in mind, notice one thing, and I'll get to it on the next slide. Underneath Minnesota laws of 2009, there's a split appropriation, part of it coming from the following fiscal year, and here's the next one. I'll show us the reason for that. If we look at the activity or the acres affected by activity, this is how it breaks down, and the activity being those protect or either fee or fee title purchase or easement purchase, which are both called protection or restoration or enhancement. And if you look under that ML 2009 column, there's a halfway down under easement says 197,747 acres. Actually, that's where that split appropriation came into effect, because that was the opportunity right at the beginning to purchase conservation easements, basically forest for the future type easements, on Blandin Paper Company lands up by Grand Rapids. So it was about 180,000 or a little more than that acres of that 197. Pardon?
186, I remember it well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 186,000, I stand corrected. The and that was conservation easements that keep those lands in perpetuity in working forest and in large tracts so there isn't fragmentation and also open to the public for use. And so you can also see that most of the activity from an acre standpoint actually happens in enhancement by far. If we look at the funds, the breakdown of funds by activity, recommended funds by activity, then you see it changes a bit. You get a lot of money for your, a lot of bang for your buck with enhancement. The one thing that I wanted to point out, that was the next one I wanted to point out something. At any rate, this gives you a good idea on how things break down from an activity standpoint with regards to the funding. And if we look at recipients, these are, again, oh, I know what it was. I have one other thing on the previous slide, the funds recommended by activity. I should point out that the years 2009 through 2011 are actual completed acreages. 2012 through 2016 are reported proposed acres. So in other words, they're working on those properties. Until they're final, the ones that are 2009 through 2011 are final. It takes a long time to get the work done. And as you can see here, it's 2016, and we only have the first three years finalized from the reports. So restoration, enhancement take a long time. With that, here's a breakdown. Next slide is a breakdown of the past recipients of appropriations. And you can see it's about 30 per year, and it breaks down between the NGOs, the local and regional units of government. The federal government was a has had two appropriations. And then, of course, state government agencies such as DNR and Bowser. And at the bottom is a small list of the representing the NGO recipients that have been, and also some of the local regional government recipients that have taken place in the past years. Conservation Partners Legacy Grant is a component of Outdoor Heritage Funds, and in each year in the appropriation language or in the bill, you'll see that there is a recommendation for funding for the CPL program. CPL program is administered by DNR. This year, I think our appropriation recommendation is a little over $9 million as it was last year. But there was a change I should bring your attention to. That was in ML of 2014. You can see it about doubled at that point. And that was because that's when half of the money, or $400,000, I believe, in that year, and it was dedicated to use for the metro urbanizing area for cities of greater than 50,000 in population. So it was an opportunity to make sure that there was money was also going where the people were. The other thing was that this whole CPL program is really geared to small grants. It's under it's $400,000 or less, and most of those are between $5,000 and $25,000. They also require a 10% match, which can be in kind or it can be cash match. But it is formulated so that small groups, small representatives, representations from across the state can happen from different communities with lots of collaboration, lots of community ownership, and lots of community involvement happen. It's been an extremely successful and well-received program. I think that's probably an understatement. This next slide shows you the URL for the address for the website for Lasard's Hands Up to Heritage Council. And on that front page, you'll see a map, this map, or this depiction of the state on the left side, with a bunch of bullets on it. And if you click on one of those bullets, it gives you a chance to kind of drill down into that area. So if a if one of the balloons says 30 on it, and you click on it, it'll bring you into that area that has at least 30 projects that have happened. And then you click on the next balloon, and it'll drill you right down into that certain project. So you get the name of the project, the actual location where it is, the county, the acres, the type of it, of activity, whether it's restore, protect, or enhance, actually even the appropriation language and the detailed reports. So you can drill down as far as you'd like, find out as much information you'd like. And this is continually updating. I wouldn't say it's on a daily basis, but as soon as the reports are done and completed and submitted on a property, it's included in the mapping. So it may be different tomorrow if you look at it. In closing, there are a couple of rugrats here that don't belong to me. They belong to the gentleman to my left, Mr. Bivelko. Lily and Marcus, and as you notice, that Lily has some headgear on her, some protective ear wear. And I don't think she wears that every day, but does she? No, she doesn't. Actually, I think Joe had them out doing a dove hunt here and giving them some outdoor lessons. So, interesting time. But you know, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is its benefits are for future generations and for tomorrow's conservation leaders and stewards. There's nothing bigger, nothing that brings bigger smiles to kids than you know dirt and bugs and water and critters. So, with that, I'd like you to just see one little, very very short video, only 20 seconds or so. See if I can get it to play here.
Okay, go let him go. Okay.
Good job.
Was that cool, Marcus?
And with that, Mr. Chair, we'll stand for questions.
Very well. Any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Thank you. I'm not sure how to ask this. We're spending a lot of money on easements, and I know we have somebody in the AG's office or someplace that reviews them for form. But do you have someone, do you read the easements to see whether folks are getting their money's worth?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness, I do not read the easements. I'm not an attorney, and we don't have an attorney in the office. So the easements that are purchased and are purchased and held by either DNR or typically the Minnesota Land Trust or maybe TNC on some, otherwise the federal government or some other, not the federal government. It would be TNC or DNR, Bowser. Within agencies, they will review and take care of the legal aspects. With regards to any other nonprofit or NGO that holds an easement and is then responsible for the stewardship and monitoring of those easements, those are organizations that follow federal accreditation and are specialists in those areas of easement. They do file the easement with us, or they do attach it. But as far as us reviewing it and looking, are the best dollars put forward, we don't review them each individually. Now, with that, I should say one thing. The council this year did, with David Hartwell as the lead for a committee, have a short investigation into easements. And they had different easement holders come in with their and answer a bunch of questions. Basically, wanted to find out how are easements being handled? Is everybody covering the criteria that's necessary? Are there holes anywhere? And I should make a correction to the Fish and Wildlife Service of the federal government may hold easements as well with outdoor heritage funds. But at any rate, from the results from that investigation or review was quite confirming to the council that the easements are being done very nicely. I can get you a report of that if you'd like and get it to the council members.
Representative Guinness.
Well, I mean, of course the NGOs are going to come in and tell you their easements are working well. That here's my experience, members, on sitting on LCCMR. Staff does review easements, reads them, but none of the staff is attorneys, and I think they do a super job of putting their finger on some things in easements that are either shouldn't be there, or on one page of the easement you get something, and on another page of the easement you take away what you've gotten. So I think we need to maybe figure out some other states are doing a better job than we are in making sure that taxpayers get a good dollar for their easement or get a bang for their buck. And it troubles me no end that we don't have a formal process for somebody who is independent reading those easements, because this is a lot of money. And some of the things I have read just gall me. So it shouldn't be us that's reading the easements. It should be somebody who's totally independent, I think.
We'll certainly look into that. Mr. Johnson, can you compare what other states do and kind of give us a little recommendation based on what other states do, and we'll look into maybe seeing if the House research staff or somebody has an attorney that can make a specific job of looking through the easements, and I think it's very important.
I don't know if that would be a – I know Colorado actually has some attorneys that are specialists in this, and I don't think they're on staff. I think they just – you know, they're paid per easement or something. But people who know land law, and I know the easements are written well in terms of everybody getting tax breaks that wants tax breaks, but that's the federal requirement. But that's not what we want. We want to make sure our citizens are getting a big bang for their buck. So I don't know how we can work on that. Maybe look at what Colorado is doing, and because they do a lot of easements like we do.
I think that would be very appropriate and a very good point. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, I think, too, when we talk about easements, our council, it was clear to me that there is a little bit of confusion maybe with the different types of easement programs. There's the prescriptive easement programs like RIM where, you know, they have a certain criteria and either that project makes it or it doesn't. And then there's the non-prescriptive projects, such as Minnesota Land Trust, where the easement is more custom to that parcel, and there's not such a strict, you know, going down the list, you know, X, Y, and Z, either you make it or you don't. And I think that's maybe where the question is. And, you know, when you look at the easement documents, obviously if they're being recorded, I think the, you know, legally they probably meet all the requirements, you know, for attorney's sakes, but I think the question is you know, the wildlife benefits, the habitat benefits, because they are non-prescriptive and they're, you know, going to be more custom, you know, that's that judgment call of is that beneficial to wildlife, is that beneficial to water, and that's, you know, that's what we're trying to get at. And so if, you know, if we have, you know, it's a judgment call by the easement, you know, the group putting on the easement, it'd be a judgment call, you know, by staff, or, you know, so that's the thing that we need to work through is, you know, who makes that judgment call, and, you know, are we comfortable with the easement, you know, land trust putting those easements on, and are we comfortable that they're making the right decision?
Well, Representative Guinness.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of a follow-up here. One of the criteria you have in here is keeping water on the land. Good criteria. But an easement may not address that or just have a phrase and it has no meaning to it. So you have good criteria, and we want to make sure the easements are actually meeting what you are saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to committee, Mr. Johnson. You may have covered this during your presentation, but I don't think so. You probably know that the governor makes budget recommendations on the Clean Water Fund and not your fund. Can you tell me why?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I don't believe I'm qualified to know what the governor's thinking, but I can give you at least why I think he maybe doesn't make recommendations, and that is because of the structure of the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council being citizen and legislator. Now that said, and the intimacy with which council looks at the different projects and proposals. That said, the Clean Water Council also has its own council, and but that stems back further back when it was a legislative body. So perhaps he doesn't feel as much connection to that since it was originally strict legislative appropriation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'm just trying to figure out how I can get the governor to give me such latitude in the future. So. Thanks for the insight.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for an excellent presentation and giving us a lot of information, especially about the council's vision and priorities and the participants or the partnerships that the council works with in Minnesota. I would like to know what, from our legislative guide that was created at the same time that the four funds were created, the principles and the outcomes, where do they come in to the council's vision and priorities? They come in the RFPs or to the request for grants or just being up on the website?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think probably the best way to put it at this point, I think they're inherent throughout. In the RFP, of course, they're stated. I can't tell you which page they're stated upon, but page two. That's why we have my assistant here. And, of course, the council is always always using those guidelines and those standing principles to continue with everything they look at. So I hope that answers your question.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, it does somewhat, but those two children there, with the little boy releasing the bird and the two children that are there, and that's part of the outcome, certainly. But are we making any progress with the partnerships and the grant, the award, the awards, are they making progress in establishing the outcomes? Do we have an increase in the percentage of all Minnesotans, Minnesotans of all ages and ethnicities and abilities who are participating in the enjoyment of the outdoors? Or is it just the people that are in the partnership groups, the already organized groups? Is there any evidence that you could add to this excellent report that you just gave us that shows that we're making some differences in some people across the state in some of the programs.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for mentioning it that way, because it gives me a chance to answer you as I think the way you, the answer you would appreciate. The council has right now has put out an RFP for a process to do exactly what you're talking about, and that's quantifying the outcomes, or at least allowing us to set up better parameters to quantify the outcomes. As you know, outputs are the acres or the miles of stream that are restored or those types of things. Outcomes are actually those intangibles. How many more kids go fishing, and are there more pheasants, and how cleaner is the water, or those types of things. Actually, how much cleaner is the water, I guess it would be. But so the outcomes are more of an intangible. The RFP that we put out is looking at two stages or two areas of focus. First of all is to get together with not just the council but also agencies and stakeholders across the state to look at how can we better measure the outcomes? In other words, first of all, looking at what computer models are available out there that tell us how these outputs translate into what outcomes. And clean water, number of pheasants or ducks or things like that happen, and they're attainable. But it's finding out what are the avenues to us that are open to be able to measure those and quantify those. Then the second step will be actually, the second RFP will actually be going into actually providing those measures and calculating that out. It's going to take a year. So it'll be next year before we have those first results coming in. The council's been kind of restricted until this point also in looking at that type of measurement because, as I mentioned before, things happen slowly. You know, we only have the first 3 years now where we actually have the results of the outputs. So now calculating the outcomes from those is, I think, it's a logical time to do that.
I think so, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson. I think so, too. And we're almost at midpoint now, and so we've got to know where we have to strengthen our priorities. And we are, you know, we've got them in the outcomes in the guide that we want increases and we want more, and that's what we were sold from the beginning. And so now we've got to find out how much progress we're making. Thank you.
When you present your bill, probably would be a good idea to be able to present some of the outcomes from the projects that we have funded in the past. And I know you're doing good things. You just got to point them out to us. And with that, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, can you tell me in LaSalle Sands proposals for the coming year, how much land is in there for fee, to be purchased in fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, it looks like, and this is not ready for prime time brochure, but at least from this quick one, it looks like with fee with PILT, we're looking at about 4,200 acres in the bill coming up, and fee without PILT, or without PILT liability, is 6,500.
Representative Green.
So we're increasing above last year again, which was a record year for land purchases. How about enhancements for easements? Not enhancements, but easements.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, for easements, we're looking at 13,400 acres approximately.
Mr. Green.
Mr. Chair, I want to clarify something, too, for the committee and for the testifiers that, you know, you mentioned that this was well received and possibly it is in certain areas, but I can tell you it's not where you're buying most of this land. It's not well received at all. There is a lot of apprehension and a lot of anger in my area in northern Minnesota over the amount of land that's being purchased. This just escalates it. At last count, I think we are pushing a third of our state is non-taxable now when you add in the not-for-profit and the state and federal lands and the lakes. And we're getting property tax poor, a tax forfeited plat books. If you open them up, all you see is tax forfeited. People can't afford their taxes anymore, and it's getting to be a real, real problem. And as far as the managing of the land, we see some of the worst land that we see out there as far as for weeds or just being neglected is state land. And yet, instead of going in for more enhancement of the properties we already own, we're now buying another 10,000 plus acres, almost 11,000 acres. We just received the updated version of the legislative auditor's report, and I've been going through it a little bit here as we're sitting here. And there is some complications in it that the legislature is going to have to deal with, in that according to the law, passed an amendment that we can't expend funds to anybody not in compliance with the law. And there is some question as to whether or not, well, most of the people getting money are in compliance. Now, I know that the DNR and Minnesota Management and Budget have said they don't agree with the legislative auditor in how he's interpreting the law, but the law states, according to the legislative auditor. So there is a problem with the money that is going to be going out this year, and we're going to have to deal with that, Mr. Chair, to you too, that's going to have to be clarified, or we may be expending funds and breaking our own law. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, just for just one comment, and that is with regards to the non-compliant parties. At this point, I don't believe there are any non-compliant parties with the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, well, and I hope that's true, but when I read this, it talks about the agencies and how, and I know that the Department of Natural Resources had testified in the last session that they weren't in compliance with what the legislative auditor said, but that there was a gray area because Minnesota Management and Budget didn't agree, and neither did they. And so that's something we'll have to get clarified, because the law doesn't say whether the DNR or Management and Budget agrees. It says according to the legislative auditor's report. And so those are something that we're going to have to look into.
John, do you have a question? Okay. Any other questions from members? Please, Mr.
Thank you, Chair Gunther. The last couple of years I've been honored to Speaker Dowd put me on Lassard Sams. I took over for when we lost Representative Dill to cancer, but it's been an interesting committee. And just to that last point, I listen all the time, Representative Green, but at the end when you said that most of them don't comply, I mean, and when I looked at the back page here, and I would think Mr. Nobles would certainly mention if Lassard Sams, specifically one-third of the money, doesn't have anything in there. We can debate that, and I'm sure we will. These committees are a lot like the committees that Chair Torgelson had last year, and Chair Erlaw has this year, like capital investment. There's so many requests, so they're whittled down, and believe me, they're very well vetted, and I would challenge many of you to come to the meetings or listen to the hearings and kind of hear how it goes. But I'd like if you're open to it, Mr. Chair, just to have them spend a few seconds. There was a couple odd things that happened this year which I thought really shined well, and it might give some comfort to Representative Green, is there was a project up north that applied for money, and maybe he doesn't want to say it, but I'm going to make it anyways. But at the end of the day, their money was rescinded, or maybe you can tell the story. Can I? And then I have some other.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly.
Sorry, I'm doing it to you, but. I think
yes, I can. Two things. First of all, with regards to the number of projects that come in, this year we had received about, the council had received about $317 million worth of requests for expenditures or for appropriations. And as you'll see when the bill comes forward, it's a little under $104 million that were actually, that are actually available. So the vetting does take place. There's a lot of cutting that has to take place in deciding what are the best projects and which aren't. There was one project which is would have been a phase three project, and I won't name the recipient, but I'll mention it, and who did some, has been doing in the first two phases some very, very good stream restoration of trout streams, or of streams, I should say, cold water streams. And in this particular instance, there was some, the DNR is the fiscal agent. They're the, or they're the fiscal auditor, basically. Auditor isn't the right word. Manager. On each of the administrator, that's the right word, on each of the accounts. And DNR had noticed that there were some inadequacies with the steps taken to avoid any conflicts of interest or apparent potential conflicts of interest. This spring, DNR came, actually this summer, DNR came to us as staff and pointed those out to us. We brought those forward to the council. By the time they came to the council meeting, the council had already had this this party, this program, in their initial choice for appropriation recommendations. And after reviewing that, then staff made the recommendation to the council, and the council agreed that funding shouldn't continue this year, that instead they should be invited to come back again in the future to do more good work, but to have all the I's dotted, T's crossed, to make sure there weren't any, there wasn't any potential of conflicts. I guess that also underscores the importance to which the council looks at the potential for any headlines, any bad headlines. They're looking at the what's the benefit for habitat and wildlife, and what's the benefit to the people of Minnesota with this expenditure of these funds. And they want to make sure it's always on the positive and not anything that's circumspect in any way.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, thank you. So I thought it was interesting that actually as a council we were moving forward with additional funding, and it was recommendation from the DNR and staff that said, hey, and called into question some of the things, and so we did stop. And there was another project this year that was asking for money, and they hadn't spent their money. So that, you've kind of mentioned that kind of sort of thing in the past and is legitimate, and that, you know, it's no secret I care about the Metro a little bit, but it it was a Metro project, and so they didn't get any money going forward because they hadn't really spent the money that they had in the past. So why give them? So, you know, there's accountability going on, and but I certainly support what Representative Murphy's saying about always measuring, and I know you're trying, you know, to figure out who's using the land and getting on and the outcomes. But it it's an interesting process, and certainly vetting them down to the final. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. You know, you get the projects you like, and people do fight for other ones that you're like, you know, you might find out that that's better than you thought. One of the problems and to Representative Green's issue is that much of the land is cheaper in rural Minnesota or greater Minnesota, and we have some great, on the flip side, there's some great opportunities to preserve some of that, and that was kind of what this thing was set up to do. So you've got, like in western Minnesota, I know Representative Guinness has just been a hero of, you know, preserving some of the prairie land. And,
she'd be a heroine.
Heroine, sorry. It's a good thing we had an author here. But anyways, so it's, you know, to preserve this, you get this opportunity. So that's, we can buy huge tract of lands and do some great work. And anyways, I'm talking longer than I should. But just to kind of wrap up, we toured some land out in the Wilmer area, and it was amazing how many there was federal groups. There's NGOs that are involved, the DNR, and there, you know, there's goats harvesting buckthorn and other, you know, just all sorts of, you know, that's owned by a local business. So there's private entities, there's just all sorts of things going on trying to do good work. And I think that's the bottom line that and it is complicated, and the auditor kind of pints out some of the mistakes, but I think overall most we find that a lot of these people are trying to do good work and make Minnesota better.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Oh, Mr. Erdahl, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Johnson, just wondering, the land that is acquired by the state or by Lessard Sams, what kind of land is this? Are we talking farmland, peat bogs? I mean, what are you acquiring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, it varies. Primarily, the land that's purchased is land that would be good for habitat. It's land that's marginal land. It's not prime farm ground. We're looking at wetland. We're looking at forest that's not high timber ground. So it's transitional lands. It's general lands that, again, it's where habitat is the best use in most situations.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Chairman. Since 2008, I wonder if there's any way to figure out what the loss in property tax base has been in land acquired by the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Do you have any idea of what that would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I don't off the top of my head. We did a land acquisition report last year. Perhaps that will shed some light on it if we do some more digging into that. We won't have those exact figures, I'm sure, because tax brackets change and everything, but we could try to put something together for you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, that would be good. I'm not interested in exact figures, but, you know, at least a ballpark of, you know, are we suffering huge losses or minimal?
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, there is much farmland being purchased. I can take you to it. So it's not all marginal lands. And most of the marginal lands in the north are already gone. We've got 80%, over 80% now, I believe, in Beltrami County alone, 37% plus in Clearwater, 25% plus in Manoman, and the list goes on and on. There's 90% areas in the northeast. And so we've got so much public land in the north that we have no place anymore to go for a water bank. And now we have a problem there. We can't do road projects because there's no place to go for a water bank anymore. So this is a real problem for us. It's not just something I'm sitting here making up. And I've read a lot of reports, Representative Lilly, and so I will go over this one again, but I'm pretty sure that what I read said there was 5 out of 6 of the recipients to legacy that still had some problems.
Any other questions? Representative Lilly, I didn't see you raise your hand.
Thank you, Chair. Since it was pointed at me, I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. You're just saying it wrong. It's not in Lessard Sams. You said legacy now in your last statement. So, and you said earlier, you said all projects, and it's just not fact. So I had to call you on it. Yes, there are some problems, but you're just, I don't know. It's this latest report, which I just skimmed also. Maybe you had an earlier copy. I didn't. But if you look on page 11, I can't see Lessard Sams anywhere. I see, but maybe you have a secret that I don't, or a secret document I don't have, but this one doesn't have what you're saying about Lessard Sams. Maybe in legacy, yes, perhaps, but not in, so that's all. And I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong, but it is wrong about Lessard Sams.
Representative Green.
One last time, we'll just, you know, and I'm not going to argue with you. Maybe we can talk offline. But a lot of this comes from the last session where a lot of this was not resolved in the fact that a good share of the projects that were done did not comply. And you'll find that on page 6 where it says unclear legal requirements now. Because of the pushback coming from Minnesota Management and Budget and the DNR, the legislative auditor now is looking for clarification from the legislature, and that's what I was saying, that we are going to have to go back in and clarify some of these things, even though I think that when you read the bill, it is pretty clear, but other people disagree. So I guess it's our job to do that.
Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you very much for your enlightening testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I'm sure we have the DNR coming up next. And Representative Green, did you read the minutes of the last meeting, the meeting of January
23rd? Yes, I did. I have to move to approve them.
Okay, Representative Green moves to approve the minutes of January 23rd. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. That's something to work out. Oh. Disapprove, say nay. Disapprove. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources Assistant Commissioner. I have with me Deputy Director Pat Rivers from the Division of Fish and Wildlife. We're here to discuss with you today lands, state land management, and I specifically try to talk about how we work with constituents and the Lasard Sam Outdoor Heritage Council to achieve the goals in the Constitution of restoring, protecting, and enhancing our state lands. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to kind of dive right in and have just a brief discussion with you all about who we are, just briefly talk about our mission statement and things like that, and then just talk about land, because when we say that we own the most land in the state, well, yeah, we do, but a lot of it is held in trust for the school kids of the state, for the counties. The counties manage county tax forfeit land. They get all the revenue. They get the money when they sell it. Concon lands, they get the gross receipts off of our timber revenue, so we're subsidizing the timber management costs on our Concon lands. And we only buy the best lands that we're buying at Lasard Sams are for conservation forever. So we have a lot of land, but a lot of land is there because it's not worth anything. Nobody wants to buy any swampland in Couchiching County that's being managed by the counties or getting revenue off of it. And then we have land that the citizens of the state, your constituents, want the DNR to purchase and buy. I always say, Commissioner Landwehr is not here saying, Mr. Meyer, go get some more money so we can buy some more land here. We're hearing it from our constituents, the people who buy hunting and fishing licenses, the people who go snowmobiling or recreating. They want that. They live here because of that. So we'll get into that a little bit. Just quickly, our mission statement, we work with the citizens to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, provide outdoor recreational opportunities, and provide commercial uses of natural resources in a sustainable quality of life. Kind of a graphic to look at to just display this is we use these three circles kind of constantly, at least I like to use them, talking about outdoor recreation, the economic development portion, and natural resource protection. And where we need to be, if at all possible, as an agency is in the middle there where it says DNR. We need to be taking into consideration the outdoor recreation opportunities, the natural resource protection, and also the sustainable economic development for the citizens of the state. And it's you'll often hear it referred to as timber, taconite, and tourism, right? We have forestry, we have mining, and we have tourism. It's kind of how we provide services, especially in Representative Layman's district in northern Minnesota. That's the way it's really looked at. So, with that, I just want to talk about our public land base a little bit and what we have here. We have 2.5 million acres of school trust fund land that was given to the state at the time of statehood. Section 16 and 36 were donated. Unfortunately, most of those lands have been sold off in the southern part of the state as farmlands, the most productive lands that are out there. Had we been wise, we would have retained those lands and leased them to people rather than sell them, and we would have more money in the school trust fund now than, I mean, it would be billions and billions and billions of dollars. We also have 2.8 million acres of tax forfeited land, which is, as Representative Greensand said, it's land that people turned over because they couldn't pay the taxes, but the state holds that land in trust for the counties. Now, most of this land is forested land or it's productive economic development land. We have several mineral rights. We have over a million acres of several mineral rights and tax forfeited lands that the state holds. But the counties really manage this 2.8 million acres of land, and they keep the receipts off of it. So when they sell the land, it goes into their general fund. When they manage their timber and harvest their timber, they get the timber receipts. Actually, most of the county land commissioner offices are funded off of the revenue they make off of county tax forfeit land. So without this land base, which is looked at as part of the state's land, they wouldn't be able to fund those activities. Consolidated conservation lands are lands that were given to the state after the counties went bankrupt and they tried draining all the lands, in particularly northwest Minnesota. And the revenues, as I stated, off of those lands, the counties get 50% of the gross receipts of our forest activities. So when we do any kind of timber cut, the counties take 50% off the top. We still have to pay for the staffing costs, all the costs associated with the sales. And those are, in cases, I mean, I can get you the numbers, but it's millions of dollars that the counties are getting every year. Really, I think what people are concerned about is the growth of the acquired lands, and we'll be talking about that, 1.58 million, which is a small percentage of the land that we hold in general for the state of Minnesota. And if you look at the maps here, I had one more land classification here. So this is just some definitions of the lands I've talked about, school and indemnity school lands, trust fund lands. If there wasn't a Section 16 or 36 that was taken, they did these indemnity lands that were selected out there. The swamp lands are a piece of this as well. University lands, these are lands that are held in trust for the university, and the funds go to the University of Minnesota. Internal improvement lands are also a classification of our school lands as well. Concon lands, we spoke to those. Those are forfeited for non-payment and taxes related to ditch assessments. Primarily Aiken, Beltrami, Coochiching, Lake of the Woods, Roseville, Manoman, and Marshall County. So if you look at Beltrami, for example, a lot of that 80% is Concon land. It's school trust fund land. It's tax forfeit land. That the county is making money off of it and is basically taking a lot of benefits, financial benefits, for having that land in their district. So when I get to another slide, I want to hit on the PILT payments a little bit. Tax forfeited lands, we just received those as well, and the counties manage the surface, and the DNR manages the mineral rights. Just a couple quick maps to kind of show you where this land is and why there is so much public land in northern Minnesota. So you look at the 2.5 million acres of trust fund land here. You can see it if you look at, I think you guys have color copies, right? Or should have color copies. You can see the different, the swamp lands, the indemnity lands, the school lands and internal improvement lands that are all part of the school trust portfolio scattered throughout the state. You can see the dot pattern, right? That's Section 16s and 36s that are still remaining. The next slide here shows county tax forfeit lands. And again, a lot of these are in northern Minnesota as well. The next one shows just where the Concon lands are, primarily up in that area of the state that they tried to drain and farm that didn't work out, and the state received those funds or those lands, and now we share the funds with those counties. And this is basically what I think the, if you want to call it an argument or where we're at with people not wanting to buy land or saying the state has too much land, these are the lands we've actually bought. These include park lands and things like that, but these are the lands that we want to conserve, protect, enhance, and restore that are the cream of the crop. These are our wildlife management areas for the most part that have huge hunting opportunity or potential, things that we went out and actively solicited to buy from the constituents, a willing seller who wants to sell their land to the Department of Natural Resources or have it become part of a park or something like that. Now this slide here, and it gets to be a little confusing when you say 90% of the land is publicly owned. What we're really talking about here are, this is state land that's owned. It includes all those classifications I talked about. So Coochiching County, for example, almost 70% of the land is owned by the state of Minnesota because there's a lot of swamp there and nobody wants to buy any swamp. But if you look at Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, right, 70 and say 60% state owned, mostly trust, mostly Concon, things like that. If it weren't for the state holding those lands in trust, those counties would probably not be in existence because of the PILT payment that they receive off of those lands. Funds over 50 to 75% of their general fund levy. The businesses that are there would never, and the residents would never be able to fund enough property taxes or taxes to actually have those counties survive. And we could go in there and sell land, but we're going to get, you know, pennies on the dollar for acres of swampland that has sometimes no access, it's non-buildable, and the only benefit it has to the state is protection for groundwater or surface water quality and timber in the wintertime. So just go back one second, Pat. You can see here, and then you take this, and then you overlay the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, the U.S., the Superior National Forest, and the Chippewa National Forest, which then gets you to where the land mass in northern Minnesota really is. So you really need to peel back a little bit of the onion to understand where things are going. And if you look down in the what will be the northwest side of the state here. You know, 10% in Kitson County, then we get 1.4.28%. I think that's probably in Big Stone County. This is the part of the state that, we really want to focus on. It's the prairie pothole region of the state. We have our prairie plan. We have all these other plans that are out there, the pheasant plan. And this is where the groundwater, surface water protection benefits of actually acquiring and protecting land are going to be most beneficial. So we own a lot of land in northern Minnesota. That's not the priority for the department right now. Our priority is the pheasant plan. It's trying to protect these natural grasslands and prairies that are out there. Not saying that there's not lands that need to be protected in northern Minnesota, but because of the amount of land that's owned, our priority right now, the department's priority, is working in that prairie pothole region of the state.
Representative Lehman has a question, but before she does, I'd like to ask one question. I see very little school trust lands down in the southern half of Minnesota, and it all seemed to shift north. How did that historically happen?
Back during statehood, most of those school trust lands were sold so they could be developed and farmed. As I mentioned, had we had a school trust lands director back then, they probably wouldn't have wanted that to happen. It would have rather been leased to them, as we're talking about leasing other lands right now, rather than selling it. So most of the lands in all of the highly productive land that people would want to own if you're a land manager and an asset portfolio has been sold when it relates to the trust, except for where there's mineral rights.
It was sold, not traded.
That was sold right outright to the landowners. Okay.
Representative Lehman.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again as well.
You mentioned the boundary waters, and I don't know if this is the appropriate place to ask you, but the chair is just talking about school trust fund lands. My understanding is there are still school trust fund lands locked up in the boundary waters. Why? And is there an ongoing effort to exchange those lands?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, that's a great question. There are still, because we've been, I think County Commissioner Rukavina may be down here tomorrow to talk about this with Representative Fabian's committee, but it's been an ongoing project with the federal government to try to figure out how to get either a land swap or a land buyout on the boundary waters canoe area. And actually, Trust Land Director Van Lindy will be talking about that tomorrow morning in Representative Fabian's committee. So we're working very actively with the federal government, the DNR, and the Trust Lands Office, and actually St. Louis County to come up with a resolution for. What's on the table right now is a hybrid. It would be three-quarters cash, one-quarter land. But there's hopefully be some money in the president's budget to begin that buyout this year.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, I'm just thinking the timing would be good. I think this has been a long-standing struggle, and the timing might be right now to move on that.
We've been actively, Mr. Chairman, working with the Forest Service this past summer and fall to try to get a proposal in their land and water conservation funding package to start the buyout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the whole Representative Perkins?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer, you went through these four categories that you had mapped out here. If someone donates land to the DNR, whether as an individual or, say, Pheasants Forever, which of these categories do those lands end up in?
Mr. Chairman,
Meyer.
Representative Turgle, and those would be considered acquired lands at that point in time.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Green.
I was going to wait as long as we're on the subject. I just want to clarify that not all these lands are water. They're not all wastelands that you're buying. And the other issue is, you know, it's not a question of who wants to sell their land. It's how much the state owned. And I know for a fact that there's places where you guys have outbid private citizens who wanted to buy that land. And I know we can hassle over the 10% or whatever, but they're not only battling against you, they're battling against the nonprofits, the Pheasants Forever, the Ducks Unlimited, the Deer Hunters. And it is really crippling us. And if the counties loved this so much, they wouldn't be in my office begging me to carry bills to prevent you from getting water to land or trying to sell off the tax forfeited land.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't trying to talk about the land we own. I just want to make sure that people understand when people say that there's that the state owns too much land. Most of the land base that we own and manage is for the benefit of the counties and the cities and local units of government, because they're getting a payment, either a payment in lieu of taxes or else directly receiving profits off of the management of the land. As far as bidding, the state doesn't go to auctions. We only work with willing buyers, and we only work with willing sellers, and we can only pay appraised value of the land. Sometimes, very rarely, there's the provision in law that allows us to pay up to 10% more, but that 10% has to be balanced off by a sale that we would then only pay 90% of the value for. So the statute prohibits us from going to auctions, and we can only work with willing sellers at appraised value.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Myers. I wasn't insinuating you go to auctions, but that doesn't preclude the fact that if there's a willing buyer and you guys are offering more money than what, in some cases, what the appraised value is, and I know this is true because I've seen it, that you are essentially outbidding the private folks for that land. So it does happen, and it's not even a question that it happens. So I just want to be clear that there is way too much state land in many of our estimations. And also, in Clearwater County alone, last year we lost 2,000 acres. It was not water. It was not swamp. And it also wasn't next to the lake. And the plus on that is that the tribe acquired and they are paying taxes on it, but it's still now no longer in private hands. And we got a lot of folks, young folks, who would like to move back. But we're just running out of places for them to buy. And because of the short shortage of land available, that what is there is priced so high now that a lot of people starting out just can't afford it. So it's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick clarification. But when Representative Green refers to you guys, I don't know who you're referring to, but it's not the Department of Natural Resources, because the Department of Natural Resources does not participate in auctions. So we do our acquisitions at a kitchen table with the willing seller, and we work through that through the appraisal process. You may be referring to other recipients of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, but it's not the Department of Natural Resources.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, Mr. Meyer, you're restricted as to how much you can pay over according to the appraised value. Do those restrictions apply to land that is given to the DNR that's been purchased by some other organization, such as an NGO?
Mr. Chairman, at that point in time, those lands are owned by those nonprofits, so they can donate them or hold them in fee title if they want to, or donate them to the state or another management entity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to clarify, if an organization goes out and pays 200% of the appraised value for a piece of property, they can turn around and donate it to the DNR with no restriction.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, yes. The one caveat would be that price now, when you look at the payment in lieu of taxes process, that land would then be reassessed basically before we got it with that new purchase price. And that PILT payment would then be based on that new purchase price, or the value that they paid for it, basically would be considered the new appraised value. So when a piece of land is acquired, the PILT payment is estimated on the purchase price for the first 5 years. So as a state payment, it's 0.75% of that purchase price. And then it's reassessed at every 5 years, or 6 years, I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question then. Your appraisal process, is your appraisal process based on comparable sales, or what appraisal process do you use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, that's an excellent question. We use certified appraisers that are often hired locally. We have a list of appraisers that we work off of that are very familiar with appraising ag land, non-ag land, recreation land. So it's based, we have a number of lists of appraisers that we work with on a regular basis.
Yeah, but you didn't. Is it based on comparable sales?
It'd be using a regular appraisal process, yes, it would.
So
just like your house would be appraised.
Thank you for your tolerance, Mr. Chair. So if the transaction involves recreational land and the appraisal price is based on comparable sales of recreational land, you're shaking your head.
Chairman, I'm sorry, Representative. I thought we were still back on the donation piece. So when we do an appraisal for a DNR-acquired property, it's a standard, you know, highest and best use appraisal that's done using, just like if you were to sell your farm or your house to anybody, they go back and they look at comparables and they come up with a price. So the acquisition appraisal, so to speak, is based on highest and best use, looking at comparables that are out there. And oftentimes what you see, unfortunately, is that the appraisal sometimes comes in higher than, well, most when you buy a house it does too, sometimes we're used to, higher than what the assessed values are, right? So I know we've gotten to conversations about the Northwoods parcel, about the appraisal versus the assessed value. That's the latest one in my mind. The question always seems to come up, though, right? So, and then sometimes these local units of government may be assessing value less than what the actual value is to entice the landholder to keep it in a contiguous parcel. I know that there's laws on how it's supposed to be appraised and the value, but I've seen personally some big gaps in there between what we see as appraised value and assessed value. But so when we buy land, it's done using standard real estate appraisal property techniques, and all of our appraisers are licensed and certified. When it's donated to us is when the PILT would be based upon that purchase price, most likely.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it takes so long with this, but my point is that if there's a limited number of sales, and a portion of those sales, a substantial portion of those sales, is to organizations that can pay higher than the appraised value and are, in fact, driving up the going rate for that type of land in that area, it can actually indirectly affect your appraisals and cause prices that are just not economical for the typical land user that Representative Green's talking about.
Representative Green.
Thank you. Just one more question. Representative Myers, do you have, or can you tell me what percentage of the state-owned land that the DNR manages, or what percentage of state land receives PILT, and what does not?
Mr. Chairman, members, if you go back to the land types by acre, all of the lands receive PILT payments. It just depends on how much, depends on the land type as to what that PILT payment is. So school trust lands, if you consider the lands, I kind of look at it this way, non-acquired lands. So the lands that the state did not buy but received, school trust, tax forfeit, Concon, Volstead, university, for the most part, receive $1.50 an acre. So that's what Coochaching County, Lake of the Woods County are receiving for those lands that the state never bought but manages. The acquired lands, the 1.5 million acres that we're talking about, receives 0.75% of the appraised value, which is reassessed every 5 years, updated every 6 years. So the next year, then those new values are updated.
Representative Green.
So that's kind of in conflict with what I read, because I thought that it was a pretty, almost 50-50 to the amount of land the state owns and what was paid PILT on. So can you give me a breakdown, because it was, at one time I thought I was reading in some of the reports that we had that only 40% of the land receives PILT, or that the state manages, receives PILT. So for all the types of land that you manage, you're telling me there is PILT?
Mr. Chairman.
Mayor.
Representative Green, there is. There's just different levels of payment in lieu of taxes that are out there. There are different categories in statute, and I don't have the statute right off the top of my head, but maybe community council could outline the statute number if you're interested, and so you can see what that is. So, and I can provide you a list of PILT payments by county as well. As I mentioned, some counties like Coochaching, I was just up in Coochaching County 3 weeks ago meeting with the county board, and that PILT payment is very much, it's over half of their general levy. Counties would actually like to see it increased again from $1.50 to $3, I think, is their proposal. But they've been receiving a payment in lieu on those lands for a long time. I mean, since it was from inception. So.
Ms. Taylor, you have an answer to that question?
I can, Mr. Chairman, I can provide detailed information okay. to the committee.
I would appreciate that. Any other question by members? Yeah, Representative Lehman.
Yeah, just we were talking about this earlier, I think, before you came up, Mr. Chair, Mr. Mayor, and that is the
the report that was just put out by the legislative auditor, and it looks like there's really a problem since the legacy funding was started in trying to implement the requirement that the money be used to supplement, not replace, traditional funding. I'm thinking that must be a real conundrum for the DNR. So I'm just wondering if you have any comments about how you do that at the DNR that might be helpful to us.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, I'm assuming we'll be back talking about this at a future hearing as well, but we actually have developed an internal operational order, a commissioner's order, that guides how we spend these dollars. And I'm not sure if the auditor didn't look at that or what, but it's kind of confusing. You see that we're cited here, but then the last paragraph of the report on page 9 says the different interpretations of directly related and necessary for and supplement not substitute requirements have created unresolved disputes between OLA and the organizations, and until either the legislature or the courts clarify the meaning of these two requirements, the OLA lacks sufficient criteria to design effective tests to determine whether we are complying with the requirements, but yet it says we aren't complying with the requirements. So that's going to have to be something we discuss, and I'll come back with more information on that. But this is just our Parks and Trails legacy funding. We also receive outdoor heritage funding and clean water funding as well, which there's not a finding on those. So, and they're handled the exact identical way. So we'll come back and circle up with you individually and as a committee on that.
Thank you very much. Anybody else have questions for the DNR? You find that, Roy? Go ahead, Ms. Taylor, talk.
Mr. Chair, members, there's a number of different categories, but for example, like $5.133 is multiplied by the total number of the acquired natural resources land. For the county-administered other natural resources land, it's $1.50. And then there's also like 50% of the dollar amount goes to the like military refuge lands. There's seven or eight different categories here depending on the type of land. But as Mr. Meyer mentioned, the acquired natural resources land gets quite a bit more.
And Mr. Chair, Meyer. Mr. Chair, just the general citation number on that chapter, if people
ask? It's 47A.12 is where I'm looking at, but 477A.12.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Meyer, I just want to say that from the people that I've talked to in Meeker County, they would like a little more green.
A little more money.
No. Green on the map.
On the map.
I thought they wanted a new representative.
Okay, seeing no more questions, thank you very much for...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we still have some slides left, so I'm going to turn it over to Pat Rivers to talk about... Unless you're done, I shouldn't have said anything, right? That was my opportunity.
I gave you a chance, remember that.
Maybe just really quickly to talk, because we only have a few minutes left, right? Or do you have it until 2:30 or 2:45?
2:45.
Okay, perfect. Our strategic land asset management, all that packet that. So I think this is where we left off. So.
You want me to start here?
Sure.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I thought Bob was going to filibuster my chance. But
give your name for the record, Mr.
My name for the record is Pat Rivers. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife. I just want to point out that our NGO partners primarily do not spend more than appraised value. I just got a text from a PF partner. He wanted me to share that, indeed, they do not pay more than appraised value. And when DNR does acquire lands, DNR acquisitions are not included in that appraisal process. So we're looking at private sales in that comparable aspect. We're striving to have a kind of a strategic lands asset management approach. This is where we look at all of our land holdings and try to find the best footprint, if you will, of what acquired lands we own, and not only acquired lands, but all of our lands. And we're working hard with our partners at the county level and the federal level, as you just heard about our work in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, trying to get our school trust lands out of that footprint. A quick example of that here is from St. Louis County. It benefits both sides, the state and the county, to consolidate our ownership where we can, not only for ease of our land use and our users who are out there on the ground so they know what land they're standing upon, but also for management. When St. Louis County goes to do their timber work, it makes much more sense to work on a large block of land than the kind of helter-skelter approach on the left side. This work does take funding, however, to get the appraisals and the comparable exchanges done, and we're working hard with our partners to do that, but it does take funding. Now, if I could talk briefly about acquisition, I work with the Division of Fish and Wildlife. Most of our acquisition is on the wildlife side, and as you've heard, we're concentrating our acquisitions in the prairie, in those counties that don't have a lot of public land. Some of those counties have, you know, 1 or 2% public ownership, so we're working hard to try to develop opportunities for our public to go out and recreate on lands in those places, at the same time protecting the remnant prairie that remains, roughly 1% of that native prairie remains. So we have an opportunity to protect it now, and we're trying to do that. There are a number of great strategic plans that we reference and try to work within. Primarily, the Prairie Conservation Plan is one of our most guiding principles or guiding posts that we work on, as well as our Pheasant Habitat Plan. We know that in collection, if we have a landscape that has 40% grassland, our pheasants do much better than if they are less than that amount. So we're working toward that in key locations. And there are a number of other places that you can see where we look for strategic direction. As we've noted, we're working simply with willing sellers. Most of these people are coming to us that they are interested in selling their lands, and we turn many of them away because their lands simply don't meet the requirements that we're looking for. And we are working hard with our county boards to try to get agreement that the lands in public ownership make sense not only for the DNR and the state, but for the county as well. As we look to prioritize lands coming to the DNR for wildlife management areas, we have a long list of criteria that we use to prioritize what lands those are. I've got a number of them listed here. And certainly lands that touch or are an inholding within existing state ownership get highest priority, as well as those that protect rare resources, as I've already mentioned. Twice a year, we have our area managers let our regional managers know what lands are available, and they prioritize them at that local level. And then we prioritize at a regional level, and then we look for different funding sources that fit these high priorities at that regional level. It's kind of a top-down, bottom-up approach. As we mentioned, most of this work starts at that local level with either a local club or a landowner who wants to see land protected. And then at the state level, we're providing that guidance as to what type of lands we want to acquire and where those parcels happen to be. The DNR does help facilitate our small clubs. You've heard about the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant, which has been a very successful component of the Outdoor Heritage Council. We help our local clubs to identify priority parcels for the DNR, and they go out and get funding through the Outdoor Heritage Council. So it's a very successful program. A couple of examples I want to highlight. This is the Worthington Wells Wellhead Protection in Nobles County. We started working with Pheasants Forever here. Actually, they started working with us. It's a small watershed with limited surface or groundwater resources. So Pheasants Forever acquired 147 acres in 2014, primarily to protect that groundwater wellhead source, but also the multiple benefits of grassland on the landscape and recreational opportunities for hunters. I'm going to read the long list of partners here just to give you a sense of the collaboration that's taking place. Pheasants Forever Build a Wildlife Area, Nobles County Pheasants Forever Chapter, E.O. Olson Trust, Worthington Public Utilities Water Lightning Commission, Okabena-Okchita Watershed District, and the Minnesota DNR, to name a few. Another great example of a
question.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
Let him finish.
When he's done. I'm almost done. I'll make sure to save time for questions. Another great example is in the Richard J. Doerr Memorial Hardwood State Forest. This was a 130-acre kind of a inholding within the state forest. By acquiring this land, we're able to eliminate 2 miles of boundary and make forest management and harvest much easier in Wabasha County. We've got many other examples across the state, including work up in the Roseau Lake Rehabilitation Area, trying to keep flood water out of the Roseau River. And just great examples all across the state. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Deliver it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to go back to what you started out saying, that the NGOs did not or do not buy above the appraised value. Is that a policy, a regulation somewhere? Is it written down, or just a matter of course? What is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, that isn't to say 100% of the time our NGO partners don't adhere to an appraised value. But much of the dollars for acquisition are coming through the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and I'm not sure of many examples where our partners have paid more than appraised value. I think the scrutiny by the council would prohibit that.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple. That's not exactly with your presentation, but you're here. And Representative Green talked about his area. I have a question about my area. But I'm puzzled about the answer Mr. Meyer gave to that the school trust lands were sold off for farming because that was the best farming in the southern part of the state. And there's very few little dots even for Section 36 or Section 16 left down there. So when the state sold that money or sold that land, did the money go to the general fund or did the money go to DNR? Or did the money get invested for the children of the future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that's a great question. By the Constitution, the money was deposited in the school trust fund account. So it went into the corpus of the account, just like any other revenue does, which is then invested, and then it spins off money for the pupils of the state of Minnesota.
So it was compounded over the years and invested and compounded, and so... So the children of the southern and central Minnesota haven't been cheated of the funds over the years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, not at all.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. District 3B. Did I read an article or hear on the radio that the fishery at French River was closing? Mr. Rivers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Percy, yes, the French River hatchery is closing.
And why doesn't the state representative know about that before it happens? And so the constituents that the state representative has to answer to about the fishery could have some smart answers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrissey, that was an oversight on our part. We apologize for that. The French River closing, we came to that conclusion within the last 2 months, and it is not closed at this time. We still have fish at the site, so we're working through that process. But with the great success story of Lake Trout and Lake Superior, the need for that hatchery is much diminished. Not to mention it is incredibly expensive to heat water from Lake Superior to raise a cold water fish. In addition, there are many improvements that are needed to that hatchery if it is to work the way it needs to work. So we're just at a fork in the road with that hatchery.
So Mr. Chair and Mr. Rivers, and I won't prolong it, but then improvements are needed. Why don't we talk about those? And why don't we talk about... talking about how the hatchery could be used for all of northern Minnesota rather than just that particular Lake Superior.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, and I do apologize for not getting to you sooner on this. I may have neglected to forward an email to you, but the French River hatchery consumes over 10% of our energy costs as an agency statewide. that by the time we get done with the fish there, we're probably better off giving each fisherman $50 bill than trying to raise a fish out of there. And we'll come back, and I'll get something set up with you right away. But as we're facing pressures within the Game and Fish Fund, we're forced to take some actions that we need to do. And relocating the production from this facility to the Spire Valley facility while still maintaining the ability to raise those fish and stock them in Lake Superior is what we're doing. So I apologize, and we will get together with you this week to walk through those things so you do have the information you need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And any other business to come before this committee today?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing none, we are adjourned.